Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Tim Gallagher. Gallagher is a falconer as well as an award-winning writer, editor, and wildlife photographer. Since 1990, he has been editor-in-chief of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Living Bird magazine. He is also the author of several books, including The Grail Bird. It's about the rediscovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker, and his memoir, Falcon Fever, A Falconer in the 21st Century. Both books were published by Houghton Mifflin. And I welcome you to the show, Tim. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks. Great to be here, Tish.
Now, your book, Falcon Fever, is part memoir, part wildlife travelogue, and part history. And it's really personal. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
Well, you know, I actually had a fairly rough childhood with my father, very overbearing father. And I think in some ways, nature was an escape for me. You know, I take my dog and just run for hours out in fields and things like that. And as I was growing up, I would sometimes raise animals that I found, like a sparrow that fell out of a nest, or, you know, I had pigeons for a while. And then I got interested in falconry at the age of 12, and that sort of was like...
Yeah, I noted that. Your book is fascinating, by the way.
Thanks.
And at the age of 12, you discover falconry, and you say it changed your life and saved your life, in fact.
Yeah, it became a real obsession to me. And, you know, it was interesting. I went to a library looking for a book on falconry so that I could learn more about it. And the only one I could find was a translation of a 13th century book by the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II.
Uh-huh.
I decided I was going to read the whole thing. So I just kept checking the book out again, and it was huge. I mean, it's the biggest book I've ever read. And, you know, finally the librarian said, well, you can't just keep checking this out. Other people might want it. And I told her, well, I'm the first person who's checked it out in 15 years.
I believe that.
Right, right. And so she finally let me keep the book for about a year. And I just read it from cover to cover. And then I went back and read the parts that I was really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways...
So this sort of filled in the blanks. I mean, you were interested in falconry.
Yeah.
You obviously at 12 didn't know that much.
Right.
And so he filled in the blanks on how to pursue it.
I look at it like he was my first falconry mentor, sort of talking to me across the centuries,
uh-huh.
Eight centuries apart.
Yeah. Now, you have a statement in your book that you said, if falconry didn't exist, I probably would not have become a hunter. Please explain this.
Well, you know, I've always loved animals. As I said, growing up, I raised all kinds of things, ducks and rabbits.
Mm-hmm.
And I started flying these birds, and they're hunting birds, and it's a major part of what they are. And I wanted to have a relationship with these birds and be helpful to them in the field. You know, I mean, it's a real tight partnership you have with a bird of prey, especially
mm-hmm.
something like a falcon. It circles high above you, and you flush game for it to chase.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so I never really had an interest in hunting per se with a gun or anything, but this type of thing with a bird really appealed to me.
Uh-huh. And can you explain to our listeners how exactly you do this? You go and find birds in the wild, obviously, and you trap them and you train them and you get them to trust you. Tell us a little bit about the process.
Well, it's really a fascinating process with a wild-trapped one. Basically, the traditional way of working with these birds was to keep them on your fist constantly. You know, you have leather jesses and a glove and a leash, and you have it attached to your hand. And these ancient falconers might spend 3 days doing that.
Walking around?
A marathon, walking around and not sleep. They'd even call it waking.
Huh.
And I remember doing that, something like that with a bird, and I read in Frederick how to do it, how you're supposed to have candles and all that, but I could never figure out how to keep the candles lit when the bird had flapped its wings.
I wonder how he did that. It wasn't the era of Bics.
Right, yeah.
So in 3 days, you can have this animal become attached to you? How do you train them away from being totally frantic?
Well, I mean, they're an interesting animal. Most animals you couldn't do that with, a wild-trapped animal.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually quickly become quite accepting of captivity. The big thing is getting them to eat the meat you give them. And then you start withholding the meat and getting them to fly a few feet to your fist for pieces of meat. And then you start doing it outside, and you tie a long line to their jesses called a creance.
Mm-hmm.
And you also start training them to a lure, which is a small leather pouch on the end of a cord, and you tie meat to that and swing it around, and they'll come and try to catch it. And there's actually a type of thing you can do called stooping to the lure, where a falcon will come diving at you as you swing the lure, and you twitch it out of the way, almost like a bullfighter. And you'll go hurling past you and go back and forth diving at you, trying to grab this lure. It's an exercise technique.
And then, so you can only hunt with them during a certain season, right?
Yeah, we have pretty much the same hunting seasons as gun hunters, except we have extended seasons. For example, the duck season starts in New York for falconry October 1st. Mm. And gun hunters, it was more like the mid to late October. And sometimes there's a break in between the early season and the late season, but we get to go right from the beginning all the way to the very end of the gun season, which might be mid-January.
So that's how
it's like the end of the first or second week it changes. But that's good, because there are a lot of places you would never take a bird if they were gun hunters in the field.
Oh, I would think not. Now, in your early days as a falconer, you said you released most of your young birds after hawking season. So I'm thinking that you don't do that anymore. And how do you keep these birds healthy when you're not hunting with them?
Well, that's a whole big part of falconry is, you fly the birds for just a little bit every day, and then the rest of the time you're just taking care of them, and you have to really, feed them a good diet and keep their weight right.
But how do they stay fit if you can't fly them outside of hunting season?
Well, you could stoop them to the lure, that technique I told you about before, and things like that. But I also let my bird go in a flight chamber, and he'll molt in that. Grow new feathers and everything. And then the next season, when I do start flying him, he is a little bit out of shape for a week or two. I exercise him. Then they get a lot of exercise, just like a wild bird. I mean, most people think that probably these wild falcons are flying constantly, but they're not. They hunt just like my bird does, and when they kill something, they tend to gorge on it, and then they'll just sit around all day, just like my bird does.
Do they sometimes they sit around for several days, right? If they get enough to eat.
Yeah, it depends on the kind. Something like a red-tailed hawk can go more than a day. A peregrine, I feed every day.
Wow. Now, I'm sure you've been asked this before. I know you're an environmentalist, and you have reverence for nature. Do you ever feel any trepidation about trapping these beautiful wild things?
Well, I have to say, a lot of the birds we work with now are captive bred, like Macduff. He's not from the wild. He's from, they started breeding them in the early 1970s in captivity.
And for my listeners, Macduff is one of Tim's
He's a peregrine falcon.
Wonderful old birds, yeah.
But no, I don't, because I actually think, in general, falconry is good for these wild birds. You drive around anywhere around upstate New York on these highways, you see these red-tailed hawks on telephone poles and wires, and they're all hunting on the edge of the road. And most of them get killed. About 90% of them don't make it to be a year old. They get hit by cars or electrocuted or hit fences or all kinds of things, or they starve to death if it's a real harsh winter. And it's particularly hard for a young bird in its first year. And those young red tails are the only ones falconers can take. They have to be an immature bird. So, a lot of times people catch those birds and they're really in low weight condition. Sometimes they have parasites and have to be wormed. And then by the end of the season, they're all healthy and robust and the weather's warm again. They can let them go.
But people have to be licensed to be able to become falconers.
It's very difficult to get a falconry license. You have to have state and federal permits, and there's an apprenticeship system. You have to find a master falconer or at least a general falconer to sponsor you, and you have to take an exam. You have to build an elaborate facility to keep your bird in that's inspected by the state, and you have to serve at least 2 years as an apprentice, and you can fly either one wild trap red-tailed hawk a year or one kestrel until you become a general falconer. And then take you 5 years as a general falconer before you possibly become a master falconer. And you need letters of recommendation, and you have to be a master falconer to fly a peregrine, for example. So there's an amazing number of restrictions to discourage casual people. Because a lot of people, they see someone with a bird of prey and they go, I want to do that.
I remember when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Because
there
didn't used to be laws in regard to this. Probably
well, they were pretty lax.
Either that or they were lax,
Right.
Because I remember kids used to have wild birds in my neighborhoods.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, without any oversight. Now, I want to talk to you about the relationships with the birds. You say the bird and the falconer gain such a deep understanding of each other, and much of the interactions between them become intuitive. To tell us about your relationship with these birds. What is it, Tim? I don't quite get it.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I can explain that, because it is intuitive. But, you know, as I said, with flying a peregrine falcon, it's called a waiting on flight. Your bird circles high above you, and sometimes so high that your bird's a little speck disappearing in and out of cumulus clouds.
Oh, that must be scary.
Yeah. So then if you're flying ducks, you'd run over to a duck pond, clapping your hands, and flush the ducks, and the bird would come hurtling down. Sometimes they're up there, and you can't see them, and you don't know they're there. But there have been times when I just knew my bird was right above me for some reason, and I flushed, and when he was about halfway down, I'd spot him in a dive. Sometimes I'd hear him first. You'd hear the wind blowing through their feathers.
Ah. So this is a real love connection, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the only way you can describe it. It's a real relationship, like with a child.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, but I don't consider it like a pet. It's a totally different thing. It's hard to explain it, because people will say, oh, they're a pet then, right? And we have something that's much... this bird can fly away anytime it wants to, and it, you know, if it doesn't want to be part of this relationship, and I don't think it's like that with a pet.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a master and a servant.
Uh-huh. And do you talk to the bird all the time? Did you have to keep it involved in your life to keep it with you?
Well, I mean, you do talk. I mean, falconers...
He's sitting here smiling because he doesn't want to tell us about the baby talk.
Well, falconers used to be known for having really wonderful voices. I mean, even here in Romeo and Juliet, Juliet says, oh, for a falconer's voice to lure my tassel gentle to lure, you know.
Uh-huh.
Using falconry terms, you know, to call Romeo back.
So there is a trick to using your voice with a falcon. Did you have to learn that?
No, you know, I think the ideal falconers are kind of energetic people, but you don't know it. They sort of seem really laid back and with a gentle voice. I had all that stuff anyway, and so I've always gotten along well with animals. But I can move really fast, and when I want to, or to flush game, or rescue my bird if necessary.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about some of the adventures with the birds? I mean, a time when you had to rescue one, or a miraculous save of one. Do you have any stories that you can tell us about that?
A miraculous save. Well, with Macduff, I had him catch a duck next to a frozen pond and go crashing through the ice and getting pulled. The duck was pulling him under.
Oh my gosh!
And I just jumped into the, broke through the ice and jumped in. And,
wow!
And I did it. You know, I didn't want to do it from the edge, going out into the water, because that could make it go into deep water. So I sort of went out beyond them and came back to the shore.
And so you got saved too. You could have killed yourself.
I was cold.
You could have killed yourself though.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, so you have these intimate relationships with these birds. Have you ever met a bird that you didn't like or didn't connect with? You know, I mean, I love animals too, but I have met animals that I just couldn't connect with.
Well, there are ones that aren't as good for whatever reason. I mean, when you think of Darwin and evolution, survival of the fittest, you mm-hmm. know that some birds are good, and some are amazing. They're geniuses, and anything that, you know, anyone could do great with them, and you just know this bird is a cut above. And there are others that are, you could tell in the wild they wouldn't be survivors. And,
yeah,
and,
you meet some lazy ones.
I'm a good hawker, and I can get them to do a good job, but you know, they're not inspired. And that's a weird thing to say for a bird. But I've had two or three birds that were just incredibly brilliant.
And the ones that aren't inspiring, did you just let them go?
Yeah, eventually. Yeah, the next spring or something.
Uh-huh. Now, you have a passage in your book about how you quit falconry for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after one of your birds got killed by a car, and you were mm-hmm. so upset about the encroachment of civilization and malls and you know, overdevelopment. To talk to us a little bit about your feelings about that right now. It's got to be getting worse.
Well, yeah, that was a terrible time. And, you know, growing up in Southern California when I did in the 60s and 70s, it was really just such a beautiful place and great place for falconry. But I just saw it overnight just turning and fields disappearing. And rampant development, malls, housing tracts and things. And sometimes I almost felt like a vulture, like some of those big ranch properties out in the hills. They'd start doing development in there, and I'd go in, and I could slip in then and hawk, because suddenly there weren't no trespassing laws so much.
Yeah.
I almost felt like a vulture going to these places and the last time the field would be any good. And it was like having to go further and further. And then I was flying my male peregrine falcon like Macduff called Silver, and I was hunting him on Christmas Eve. And it wasn't a terrible field, but there were a couple of roads cutting through it. And he chased a pigeon way over by a road and went stooping through the diving through the road and got hit by a car.
Oh, it's horrible in the way you describe it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I ran over there. It was just like he vanished. I didn't even see him go. And then I saw this station wagon slowing down, and he just fell off the grill. And the woman who saw, I went and picked him up, and she just started crying, and, it was awful.
So that discouraged you for a while. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Gallagher. We're talking about his book, Falcon Fever. So as somebody who's into the environment, you're also an environmental photographer, a wildlife photographer. Are you worried about the way the land has been disappearing everywhere?
Well, I am. Yeah, it's been a nightmare to me growing up. I just can't believe how bad it's gotten. It was funny, though, like moving up to upstate New York from Southern California, the rate of things like that happening here is so much slower.
It is.
The winter, long winter season when you can't do much construction or anything. Whereas in California, it was just 12 months of the year. And I'm depressed going back there. I go back there. I remember places where I used to ride my bike to golden eagle nests and white-tail kite nests, and those places don't even exist. I'll go somewhere and I go, I know it was right here, and I'll just be in the middle of concrete and, big mall or...
Yeah, I know. It is sad the way we are destroying the land.
Yeah.
Just in general.
Right.
All of us who love nature and what's happening to all these species and what's going to happen to us because of this.
Well, I know.
Yeah, we're going to lose touch with our humanity. You think of falconry as an art, not just a sport. Can you tell us, is it a lost art? Is it a dying art?
Well, it's not lost yet.
Yeah, but there are very few people really, who do it anymore, huh?
Well, I think it is an art because it's so ancient. We go back, when I talk about Frederick II in the 1200s, what he was doing and what we're doing is totally recognizable to each other. I mean, I could go into his castle and be one of his falconers tomorrow, and there wouldn't be any learning curve. His people could do the same here. And it's such an ancient sport, we don't even know how old it was. I mean, there's a Sumerian bas relief of someone who appears to be holding a falcon. And then I've read in Aristotle and Pliny the Elder about seeing people in Thrace flying raptors at game and sharing the game with them. And
that is so quite amazing how far back it does go. Well, why do you think there are still so few women involved? Is it a boys' club and they're not welcome, or are they just not interested?
No, that's not. And there are a few.
There are very few.
Who are really good. I just think, it's more, maybe they just aren't, most women just aren't as interested in it. That's all I can think of because, I've known several who are really great, but there aren't as many. I don't know why.
Yeah. It used to be a sport of aristocrats, right? And now it's not, obviously. Have there been any changes through the centuries in the way that it's done? Is it really all just like the ancient times?
Well,
have you adapted new techniques?
It wasn't always an aristocratic sport. I mean, there was always the aristocratic element, the knights and the kings and emperors, but they always pretty much flew falcons. But there were always these yeoman hawkers who'd fly goshawks at rabbits. And these are birds that would take a lot of game, fill up their larder. It was before the invention of the shotgun. And they were like a feathered shotgun, similar, and take game birds and rabbits and so forth. The invention of the shotgun kind of killed the working class falconry.
Really?
Yeah.
You can really attribute it to that.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Now, before we do run out of time, I want to talk about the grail bird. That was your adventure with the rediscovery of the ivory-billed woodpecker. Talk to us about how all that came about.
Well, that was pretty amazing. I'd heard about the ivory-billed woodpecker in the early 70s. I remember reading an article about it and just being fascinated about this guy, John Dennis, who found them before in Cuba. And then later he had some in Texas, he said, and no one believed him. And, you know, it just seemed like a fascinating story, the whole idea that this huge American woodpecker that was only in the swamp forests of the South and had disappeared. And were there any left? And from time to time, there'd be sightings.
Yeah.
And actually, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology had an interesting history on this bird, too, because the founder of the lab, Arthur Allen, he found a nest in 1924. And at that time, people thought they were already extinct. He found a nest in Florida, and it was like this big hullabaloo that the bird's not extinct. It's been rediscovered. Mm-hmm. It was in all the papers. And some taxidermists who lived near there in Florida, they went out and shot the birds.
Oh, my gosh. When you hear about things like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's just awful. So then, later in the early 1930s, there was a guy, Mason Spencer, in Louisiana, and he was talking to someone from the State Game and Fish Department about ivory-billed woodpeckers. And he said, oh, we still got them about where I live. And the guy didn't believe him. He finally gave him a collecting permit and said, well, prove it. And he went out and he shot an ivory bill and brought it back and threw it against the guy on the guy's desk. And this is like they still have that one taxidermied in the Game and Fish Department headquarters in Baton Rouge. But anyway, that caught the interest of a lot of ornithologists. And when Arthur Allen had his sabbatical, he went down there. It was a place called the Singer Tract, 80,000 acres of virgin swamp forest, one of the
was
last
that, was that in Louisiana?
Like that, in Louisiana?
In Louisiana, yeah.
Yeah, and they photographed the birds and recorded them in a sort of primitive sound recording device. And those are the only recordings we're 100% sure are ivory-bill. Mm. They also took movies that we still have, and it's really amazing. But that forest was cut down after that. So again, they kind of disappeared. And there have been people every few years after that who... I found a nest tree up in the barn at the Lab of Ornithology that they'd brought back from Louisiana in 1935. It was one that the birds nested in. And I thought it was somewhere around the lab. I didn't know. And I found it out in that old white barn. And I was just amazed. And I had the pictures of the birds on it. And it kind of touched right where the bird had been.
Uh-huh.
And that's what kind of inspired me. And I thought, I want to go around almost like an oral history project and interview people who have seen this bird, mostly old people,
who've
seen it in the 30s and 40s.
Uh-huh.
And I started going around doing that. I interviewed Richard Poe, who was the first president of the Nature Conservancy. I went and stayed at his house. He was 99 years old. I interviewed him about an ivory bill he'd seen there. And I talked to Nancy Tanner, who was the widow of James Tanner, who'd been on the Cornell expedition and then done a bunch of studies for a couple of years.
And so the ivory-billed woodpecker is still around.
Well,
is that
anyway,
what we've concluded?
We were doing this, and you know, I had a friend Bobby Harrison from Alabama, and we were both checking up on sightings because we kept finding people who'd had more recent sightings, hunters and stuff.
And are these people taking pictures? Why do people not believe these stories? Is no one taking pictures?
Well, it's hard to get pictures. I mean, you're out there in this sort of hostile environment with cottonmouth water moccasins trying to get into your canoe.
Well, that shouldn't stop people with digital cameras.
So you almost have to try it before you realize how hard it is.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah.
So we had a sighting. We found someone who'd seen a bird 6 days earlier, a kayaker in Arkansas, and we went down there, and we had the bird fly across in front of our canoe and start to land on a tree.
Oh, that must have been amazing.
We sort of did all the field marks as it's going by. I go, oh, why don't, you know? And then we both yelled at the same time, ivory-bill, and the bird just
took off. We don't want you to know we're here.
And we paddled as fast as we could to the side of the bayou and kind of crashed in, abandoned our canoe, and we were just running and tearing our clothes on branches and climbing over fallen logs. And we were finally like almost in cardiac arrest. And Bobby just laid down on a log and he said, I just saw an ivory-bill. And he's just crying. Tears.
Oh, my God.
He's this big guy with a beard.
So you really did see it. That must have been an amazing moment.
It was.
But we almost had some extinct bird hunters at that point.
Yeah.
Oh, what a high time in your life. Tell us about your job as editor-in-chief of Living Bird Magazine.
Yeah, that was almost the perfect job for me. I actually moved out here from California to take that job. And I do a little bit of everything there, basically. You know, I sort of establish the editorial vision, what the publication is going to be like, and then in every individual issue. And I work closely with the designer. But plus, I write articles often, and I take photographs. I'm a wildlife photographer. So I've gotten to use all of your skills and interests. I've gotten to go to really interesting places, you know, Greenland a couple of times, Iceland, lots of other places doing, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, what are some of your other interests besides falcons and birds? Do you have other interests in regard to nature?
Oh, in regard to nature, because mm-hmm. I was going to say I like music and all kinds of
No, in regard to nature. Yeah, are there other interests that you have as an environmentalist and a photographer?
Well, yeah, I love all of nature. In fact, more and more I've become a scenic photographer. I used to just like want to take close-ups of birds and elephants or whatever, mm-hmm. whales. But now I'm really more and more interested in capturing the whole environment and having maybe a smaller image of the creature in mm-hmm. its native habitat, because they're part of that environment. The environment goes, you don't have to worry about the individuals. They're gone. They're totally tied to their ecological niche.
Uh-huh. So you're taking pictures of the disappearing landscapes around us.
I was amazed going to Greenland a couple of times over a couple of different periods and seeing how the next year this glacier had receded much more and this little wetland that was feeding was starting to dry up. And it's got to be like that all over up there.
I'm sure. We only have about a minute left. Any future books? Are you working on any major projects?
Well, I am. It's sort of along the lines of the grail bird, but I'm interested in the imperial woodpecker of Mexico, which is a bird that's the closest relative of an ivory bill, but there hasn't been a credible sighting since the mid-1950s.
Mm.
And you know these birds are almost like a dinosaur. They're the largest woodpeckers that ever lived, and it's like where woodpeckers reach the ecological limit of size limit for that body design. I've been going through the mountains, the Sierra Madre Mountains, which is the only place they were ever found, and trying to find people who remember the birds.
Mm.
And so far, the people have been older, mostly people in their 80s and 90s, and they'll remember it and really enjoy talking about the birds. A lot of the younger people don't even know anything about it.
So we can expect a book about that soon.
Yeah, yeah, and it's a bit, the only bad part about it is to get to some of these areas, you have to go through some major drug-growing areas and things like that, and, you know, can be risky, but boy, I tell you, going to some of those villages where they don't have electricity or telephone, and they all ride horses and mules and shoe their own horses. It's just like, being in the 1800s.
Wow. Well, we will look forward to that new book. We have run out of time, so I thank you so much for being with us. Tim Gallagher, the book is called Falcon Fever. Thank you.
Thanks, Dish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.